Now on Radio 4, it's Word of Mouth with Michael Raisin.
Hello, well, today's Word of Mouth finds me in Cambridge, and I'm standing in a car park with Dr. Sarah Ogilvie from Lucy Cavendish College. Sarah, fill us in. Why are we here?
We are here for the Language Endangerment Conference, which is bringing together many international scholars and people from Indigenous communities around the world to talk about how we can not only document languages, but also teach them and revitalize them.
And why is that important?
Because sadly, languages are being swamped by larger dominant languages. So we are living in a time in history where we're actually losing about one language every couple of weeks. So there's a great urgency now to not only record languages, but to document them in such a way that when the Indigenous community wants to start speaking the language again, there are documents there that are useful tools for them to do that.
But why should that matter? I could make an argument for internationalism. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the whole world all spoke English or Esperanto? It wouldn't matter, but all spoke one language and then, you know, man shall speak unto man and all that. Why are we saving languages spoken by 23 people?
Well, there are lots of people who might think that and believe in that, but I'm in the camp who believes in diversity. And I think just as it's very important to preserve endangered species of plants and animals, so is it important to preserve different languages and cultures, because within each of those languages and cultures lies a unique way of viewing the world and seeing the world in a whole new way. And that personally is something which I find fascinating, and that's why I've devoted my scholarship to studying endangered languages.
So what can we expect today?
Today is going to be amazing. We are looking not only at language documentation, but actually at pedagogy and revitalization. So we are looking at how we can document a language in such a way that we can prepare it for the time, which might be now or it may be in generations to come, where people want to start speaking their language again. So it's looking at language documentation in a new way, so that it's not just language description for scholarly purposes, but that it's a practical way of collaborating with members of Indigenous communities, working together, building capacity so that we are sharing our linguistic knowledge with the Indigenous people, and so that we are all together working towards documenting the language and the culture. Because ultimately, it is up to these Indigenous people to revitalize their languages. We can't do it. It is up to them.
And I think it's just about to begin.
Let's go.
Well, good morning and welcome to you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Dr.
Well, we've just heard the first speaker. We've got about 150 delegates here. We're in one of these august buildings of Cambridge University, a few beautiful cornices and door frames, clustered in front of the obligatory modern screen, the interactive screen, and people are milling about, having tea and coffee and speaking to each other in a variety of languages. It's all quite exciting. I'm enjoying this. And I'm just going to grab the first plenary speaker. Peter Austin, you were just talking to the conference as a whole. What's your area of interest in research?
Well, my main research is on language documentation. So what are the kinds of ways we can go about recording and documenting languages, but with a particular focus on the Aboriginal languages of Australia, especially Eastern Australia and Southern Australia.
Now, you've been working with one community in particular. So what kinds of work have you done, and what's really been the outcome?
Well, my research, again, dating back to 1972, was to collect basic information on the language. So details about vocabulary, about sentence structure, how do you express certain ideas and thoughts in that particular language. And in the last 15 years, have been working together with a team of school teachers, information technology specialists, Aboriginal community members, to develop materials that are used in the teaching of this language in schools. So what originally started out as a basic documentation of the language has now moved on to teaching the language in school. And this is sometimes given the name revitalization, so revitalizing the language, giving it a new life, giving it new functions.
Next, I'm very pleased to welcome Julia Salabine of SOAS.
My name is Evaristo Obiden. I work at the University of Salamanca.
And just take us back to a general point, Evaristo, which is, why are we bothered about endangered languages?
That's a very good point, as many people, mainly from dominant languages, tend to view smaller languages as something that is of no use, as something that is typical of uncivilized or barbaric people, languages that tend to be seen as poor, that do not have the terms to describe society as it is nowadays. However, there are several arguments that show the importance of those languages. One of them is, for example, that they are better than any language coming from abroad, from a different reality, to describe the reality where they are now. We can see even nowadays that after 5 centuries that Spanish has been in Colombia and Venezuela, still there are words that are simply not useful. For example, the seasons. So you ask, what season are you in right now? Somebody living in Colombia or Venezuela, and they don't tell you spring, autumn, winter, whatever, because it doesn't make sense. Therefore, the level of accuracy to describe reality will always be better in the language that has been there for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, than the level from a language that is coming from abroad that was not created in that reality.
So the people you're working with, how would you describe them?
Well, they have a treasure to tell. That's my experience when I was there. They are very poor, they are marginalized, and therefore their language has very little protection. I'm talking about the groups in north of Argentina. They live just by whatever the state wants to give them.
So the last thing on their mind, surely, is whether they go on speaking their pre-Columban language. Surely the best thing they can do is to learn perfect Castilian or standard Argentinian.
Obviously, the dominant culture was the same thing as being a better economic situation. Now, the approach of this project, what we want to achieve is that you can have a decent economic situation by learning how to commercialize your language and your culture. Now, they want to have their voice recognized as well. So there's a whole treasure. There's a whole treasure of who they were before the conquest, what are their beliefs, and so on. And the aim of this project is to help them commercialize that so that being indigenous is not an obstacle to have a decent life, but a help in the process.
Well, it's the lunchtime at the conference now, and we've come outside. It's a lovely sunny day. I think winter is officially over. So, I'm speaking to
Ulrike Seeshan. I'm from the International Institute for Sign Languages and Deaf Studies in Preston University of Central Lancashire.
And can you explain why sign language would be endangered?
Yes, we work with highly unusual linguistic and sociolinguistic situations. That is the case of very small-scale sign languages that are in villages that have a high incidence of hereditary deafness. Long-standing deafness for genetic reasons in these villages leads to a situation where actually the sign language arises in the community as a whole, so both deaf and hearing people can use the sign language. These small-scale communities have very few people, so there can be a few dozen, and because these are small communities, communities, and we work in India, Turkey, Mexico, various countries. So because of their size and because they are larger urban sign languages that are dominant at the national level, so these small-scale village sign languages come under pressure.
So we've got the two themes of the conference going on here, which is endangerment and revitalization. So apart from studying it, what actually is your role?
Well, we document these sign languages because they are endangered, but we are also trying to raise awareness about this very unique cultural and linguistic heritage in these countries. So, for example, in India, we already have in excess of 1.5 million urban sign language users. It's a very big community, and there's just this little tiny village with 140 deaf people among 14,000, and they have this other different sign language and similar situations in other countries, in developing countries. So this is a very unique situation, so we would like to document this as a heritage. And we also set up deaf school programs. So in this village in India, we have set up school access for the deaf children, because they have not had access to schools first, and all that creates more awareness and a sense in the community that this language is of value.
Now, you have two companions with you. Just so that listeners get a picture here, we have Ulrika, who is obviously speaking to us. We have Cesar Ernesto Escobedo Delgado, who comes from...
He's from Mexico.
...who is signing, and we have Hassan de Cuva, who's signing. I'm going to guess comes from Turkey?
Yes, he's saying that's right.
And then Michelle is interpreting, and Ulrika is speaking to us.
So Hassan is saying, my presentation focused on Mardin Sign Language, which is one of these minority small languages in Turkey. There have been three generations of deaf people in an extended family in Turkey, and they have their own sign language. And the interesting thing is that their family name is Dilsiz, which in Turkish means deaf. So deaf is actually their family name. And this is a special small group, and the language is almost going to die out now, because all the family members have now relocated to Istanbul and to Izmir for work. So we are documenting this language, and we work with the language community in our project.
Right.
Also, Ernesto is saying that in this village of Chican in Mexico, where I work, all the researchers from the United States and from Europe have come. But our approach is that we don't want just to get in, take the data, get out and publish it. We need to interface with the community. So in the village of Chican, the Chican Sign Language, I've been thinking the important thing is to give something back to the community. We want to have some better way of education, for example, in the village, because people are confused between the National Mexican Sign Language and the Chican Sign Language. So some better language awareness about the value of the indigenous sign languages.
Virtuaalilla maailmissa ja lehui saa oman päässä muisteli holmuiden, että saamme kielä sahtamaan jo ahpa internetas ja virtuaalilla maailmiin pohtaa.
I'm Hanna Outokoski, and I'm North Sami teacher from Umeå University in Sweden.
I just said that it has been an honor to be able to come here and tell about what I'm doing a little bit, and what it means for the Sami people to be able to learn their language.
Just say your language again.
The name North Sami.
And tell us about the people who speak this and what kind of a language it is.
Well, North Sami is one of the indigenous Sami language in Europe.
And how many Sami speakers in all are there? North Sami, about all the...
all the others?
Yes, in total.
Speakers, I don't know how many exactly, but about 100,000 Sami accounted for, and maybe that is even maybe a little bit too positive picture of the population, but speakers, it's maybe a third of the Sami population that can speak some of the Sami languages. North Sami and all the Sami languages belong to the Finno-Ugric language group.
So they're related to Finnish, are they?
Yes.
Yeah, I see. And what's your work? What do you do exactly?
I teach North Sami at university.
Now, you did a presentation earlier and you showed us some new technology that we're using.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you'll have to assume that both me and perhaps some of our listeners have no idea what this is. So you're going to have to get pretty basic with us and tell us what it was you were doing.
Okay, so
the basic problem for North Sami and all the smaller languages in Sweden is that our students are scattered all over Scandinavia. And in Sweden, we have lots of distance and net-based courses in languages. And for me, this was a problem because the students still have to learn how to speak the language, and in my case, North Sami. So I had to find a solution where the students could work together and speak to each other and do some meaningful things together so that they felt that they are also learning the language. So that's why I was looking at an environment, and I found this 3D environment called Second Life, where you can speak to each other and people can do things there.
When you say environment, that's what I would call a computer program?
Many people would probably say that it looks a lot like a gaming environment.
And then do they have an image that is them, so can they move themselves around in the environment?
Yeah, so they have their avatars, that it's called role figures in this world, yeah.
Right, and are you in this world?
Yes, and I am in that world, and I have my Sami clothes there, so they can identify and see where I am as a teacher.
And back in this world, are people speaking to each other? Is there a you know, if it's across distances, if there's let's say a young woman in Sweden and someone else in Norway and so on, how are they speaking to each other?
Well, there is something called voice chat, so you can speak to each other in real time. So it's just like as speaking through Skype or on the phone. So you will hear the other person answering to your question right away. So you can speak to each other right away.
And what's your role in that? Are you listening in, or are you just letting them go and doing it?
My role is, I have lots of roles. So I'm there to control that they speak the language. I'm there to design all the tasks. I'm there to help them when they need help. And I'm sometimes there to test them too. So I have another avatar that is, they don't know who that is, who comes in and speaks Sami to them and tries out if they have learned to speak.
And about how many users have you got, do you think?
My groups are not very large, so I have about 14 at a time that come to Second Life. That's the highest number, but the usual is that they meet in pairs and come in.
How would you describe what it does for people to learn a language that they feel is theirs, but if they weren't doing it, then it would sort of disappear or something? It's very hard to describe what that means for people, but how?
Well, there are already many Sami who have lost. There are generations that have lost the language, and most of the young people who come to me now and start as new beginners, they say that, oh yes, we have it in the family and it would be very nice for me to learn so I could answer to my grandfather or grandmother. So it's very important, and of course many people also are hoping that they could start speaking this language to their children so that it would become more alive again.
Well, I think we're to come now to what must be probably the most endangered language of all. And I'm with Andrew Nevins and Maria Cunelli. Perhaps you could tell us about this. Perhaps begin with you, Andrew. What are we talking about?
We're talking about here a language that's used to communicate over long distances. This is the whistled speech of the village of Avia on the island of Evia in Greece. And this has been traditionally used by shepherds to communicate over very long distances, sometimes up to a third of a kilometer. It's very resistant in a way that you cannot shout that far and be intelligible. But this form of languages, which are found all over the world and in Europe, the most famous case is on the Canary Islands, these forms of whistled languages, which originally evolved in particular ecological niches to deal with distances and to deal with particular types of traditional activities, is somewhat rendered obsolete by the development and spread of cellular phones. With cellular phones, you can now communicate over long distances with no need to be able to whistle so far. And indeed, you can do so privately. The ability to gossip and not transmit your information to everyone nearby who's whistling and can hear.
So, Maria, I wonder whether you could tell us something about these whistle languages. Is it a single language that is shared across Europe, or are they translations of the local spoken language? Does it have its own grammar?
Yes, so a whistle language is just, as you said, kind of translation of the local language. It is another way to speak the language. The form is unspoken, it is whistled. So across Europe, the languages are different, and this is why the whistle language is different. The rules of transferring the spoken form to the whistled form are not the same in all languages, but the vocabulary and the grammar are of the spoken form of the language. For example, in Greece it is Greek, in Turkey it's Turkish, in Spain it's Spanish.
So can I imagine that, let's say, 300 or 400 years ago, a whole village might be talking to each other by whistling? They could say, hi, how are you? Oh, I forgot to buy some bread. I'm just going to go and buy some bread now. See you later. Nice dress you're wearing.
Yes, they could say that all the inhabitants of the village knew how to whistle. They didn't use just whistling. Whistling was another way to talk. But yes, they could say all these things in the whistle language.
So tell us about the people who you found whistling, and it'd be lovely to hear some. I think you've got some recordings. Give us some examples.
This first recording is a recording of Mrs. Georgia, and she's probably one of our most active whistlers. She and Mrs. Kula, they sort of compete for who is the best surviving whistler of the town. We'll hear Mrs. Georgia first.
Sakaki. Sakaki.
And that was her saying sakaki, which means
jacket
in Greek. And now in this next recording, we'll hear Mrs. Kula saying
mera, mura,
which means blackberry, or it's a kind of berry. Yeah.
Yes,
and she's an excellent whistler, very loud. These recordings, we in fact, hurt our ears to take in the same room, because this is meant to travel over long distances. But like many of the older whistlers, Mrs. Kula's accuracy is being affected by her loss of teeth. She actually put in her dentures to have more accuracy for these recordings. And, you know, that is really a factor in accurate whistling.
And how old are these women?
They're in their 60s, late
60s. Well, 70 years old.
Can you tell us, Maria, something about how the sounds are produced? I mean, I'm sort of a bit kind of one-channel whistler. I just do it one way, you know, the way, and I can't do that. See, I can't do it. I mean, these guys, what are they doing? They're rolling their tongue up?
Yeah, they curl their tongue back.
Yes.
And then with their teeth.
So do you think that, today we're talking about survival. So is it your feeling that the way this whistling language is going to survive is that it's going to be fun for the kids to keep it going, or are there other possibilities? What do you think, Maria?
Yes, one possibility is that it will be fun for the kids to learn the language. And of course, the other possibility is to make people aware of this cultural heritage, that it is important to save their language.
And I believe you were showing earlier that there's one part of the world where they, in fact, have whistling festivals. Is that right? Where's that?
That's in this Kuzkoy, this Turkish village. Every June, they have a kind of whistling festival to see who's the best. I think, actually, it's a bit like I've heard there's a festival for Tuvan throat singing in Tuva every year. And they see who's the best in various categories. And I think competition sometimes for these types of skills can be a way to get people practicing, to get people to feel rewarded, to really feel like, hey, he's a champ, and to feel valorized for their skills in this, which is really a kind of art form.
I've just said kia ora to you. Welcome. Hi, Mike. It's great to have met you. Great to be here today on this island of yours.
Yeah. Well, it's great to meet you too. Can you tell us your name and what your job is?
My name is Tania Ka'ai. And I'm a professor in Māori Innovation and Development, but also the director of Te Pukaria, the National Māori Language Institute in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
So perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about what it was that you were telling the conference.
My presentation was looking really at the place of technologies digital technologies and the way in which these can be applied to language revitalization, and using Māori language as a case study.
So we're talking about computers, we're talking about mobile phones, we're talking about websites.
We're talking about anything from smart boards, video conferencing, any computers, any form of technology that is relevant to kids today. And so with regard to language revitalization, that's a tool. Those are the tools that we have to use to archive, preserve, revitalize, and ensure that our languages are preserved for the future. It's the new way, and we shouldn't fear that. We should embrace it and see it as an opportunity to take us into the future. And what's happening at home is, when we do our show and tell to the older generation, they immediately see the potential for, oh, I want 56 iPhones for all of our grandchildren and great-grandchildren, because then we can put a photo on and then they'll see what their grandfather looks like and can speak in the language and hear us. So they immediately they can see the relevancy of that technology. And I've asked this question saying, what's changed when, you know, when we were younger, we were very precious around our knowledge. And do we retain that notion of being precious and not sharing at the risk of losing the language and losing that knowledge? Or do we share it with a view to ensuring that it's there for everybody to access, knowing that we're a global people? 120,000 of us live in Australia. Some of us live here in the UK. We're all over the world. And now people can access that through the web, press on play, and their world is transformed through quality language, quality resources, and they can learn at their own speed.
It's also offering the possibility to be Maori anywhere in the world.
Yes.
Whereas in the past, for many people, you were Maori in what I call
New Zealand, yes.
Right? And then as you migrated into Australia or over here, then yes, you ceased to be Maori.
Mm.
But now there's a possibility that, in fact, people can sustain this perhaps longer, or I don't know, start getting foreverish about it, but certainly for longer if they want to.
Yes, and it's around taking your identity and crossing borders. It's endless possibilities.
Mm. So I can see governments hating it.
Tough. We're here to stay. And it's really about sharing languages and in that virtual space to enrich each other. And it crosses boundaries.
Word of Mouth was presented by Michael Rosen. It's based on an original idea by Frank Delaney and was produced in Bristol by Beatrice Fenton.